live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a proposed solar and battery storage project in Sullivan County could become the largest of its kind in the Catskills and Hudson Valley. But as the state begins reviewing the application, residents and local officials are raising environmental and ethical concerns. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar joins us to explain what's driving the project and why New York is seeing a surge in large-scale solar development. Experts say the Asian longhorn tick has become established in parts of the region where it can severely impact livestock and spread a parasite linked to cattle deaths. We'll hear what researchers say everyone should know about protecting animals and themselves. Plus, the Borscht Belt Festival returns to Ellenville this weekend, and Women of Substance, a new art exhibit. After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump is issuing new threats against Iran. The president wrote on Truth Social this morning that going forward, any time Iran attacks a ship in the Strait of Hormuz, the U.S. military will bomb and destroy a bridge or a power plant in Iran. Trump says that includes those in or near Tehran. Arizona Republicans advanced allies of President Trump in the state's primary races yesterday. Ben Giles from member station KJZZ has more.
Far-right candidates are sweeping statewide primaries. Congressman Andy Biggs is now the GOP nominee for governor here, and state lawmaker Alexander Colladan won the GOP race for Secretary of State. They both cruised to victory in the primary, largely thanks to endorsements for Biggs from President Trump and for Colladan with the backing of Turning Point, the political machine founded here in Arizona by the late Charlie Kirk. But the thing is, Trump's endorsement and Turning Point's backing isn't as meaningful in the general election when these MAGA candidates have to appeal to a broader portion of the electorate.
Ben Giles reporting there. The governor of New Jersey says a software error led to more than 6,000 non-citizens being registered to vote. NPR's Miles Parks reports the issue has been resolved, but such incidents have been shown to fuel conspiracy theories.
The software error meant that thousands of people who answered no to the question, "Are you a U.S. citizen?" at a DMV, were still registered to vote anyway. New Jersey's governor, Mikey Sherrill, called the problem serious, but she also said fewer than 400 of the mistaken registrants actually voted, and the erroneous registrations have now been removed as well. These sorts of bureaucratic errors aren't unheard of. Oregon dealt with a similar issue in 2024, but non-citizens have never been shown to register on purpose in anything but very small numbers. Still, experts expect these sorts of errors to be spotlighted by those looking to cast doubt on the entire election system this fall. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration is pausing more than $1 billion in federal Medicaid payments to Minnesota and California over alleged fraud concerns. Federal officials say they'll withhold payments until the states verify that certain Medicaid claims meet federal requirements. Erica Zurich from Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Minnesota officials say the $200 million federal officials are withholding makes this the third time payments have been delayed over alleged fraud in health programs. In a written statement, Minnesota Department of Human Services Temporary Commissioner John Connolly says federal officials haven't provided an explanation on how the deferral amount was calculated. The state says it has cooperated with the federal government to prevent the misuse of health funds. California's Governor Gavin Newsom posted on X that the state is being targeted for political reasons and not because of fraud. For NPR News, I'm Erica Zurich in St. Paul.
This is NPR News. Disability rights advocates are encouraged that attorneys general in more states are dropping out of a federal lawsuit challenging a cornerstone of civil rights law. Missouri is one of the latest states to withdraw. The suit argues the federal government doesn't have the authority to require states to help fund community supports and life in the community for people with disabilities instead of institutions. 17 states initially filed the lawsuit. About five are still plaintiffs against the Department of Health and Human Services. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has formally approved a plan to stop collecting demographic data from employers. Since the 1960s, the data has been used to help fight discrimination in the workplace, as NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The EEOC voted 2-1 along party lines to move forward with this major change. Once a year, large employers must give the government information about the race and sex of their employees. But the agency's current chair, Andrea Lucas, says this reporting requirement imposes significant costs while offering limited enforcement value. She also says it may promote rather than reduce discrimination. Meanwhile, the lone Democrat on the commission, Kalpana Kodagal, says ending the data collection will kneecap the agency's ability to investigate discrimination. Now the public has 30 days to weigh in. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
President Trump will travel to Dover Air Force Base today to attend the dignified transfer of the remains of U.S. service members killed in Iranian strikes in recent days. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. A solar developer has submitted an application with New York State to build a large-scale solar and battery energy storage facility in Sullivan County. If approved, it would be the largest solar project in the Catskills and Hudson Valley. But some residents and officials have raised concerns, notably environmental risks and ethical concerns over the involvement of some property owners. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar has been covering this solar development, and she joins us now live in studio. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in, and thanks for working on this story. But let's remind folks, like, at a high level, what is this solar project that's been proposed?
Yeah, so this solar project has actually been in the works for years. It's just that the solar developer, RWE, just submitted their application with the state actually on Monday. So essentially, this solar developer, RWE, filed with the state's Office of Renewable Energy, Siting, and Electric Transmission, or ORES, on Monday. If it's actually approved, the project would be actually the largest utility-scale solar project in the Catskills and the Hudson Valley full, you know, area. The project itself would span between the towns of Forestburg and the town of Thompson, and it would sit on about 1,200 acres of land, so a significant amount of land in the county. The solar project itself, in terms of how much land would actually be on the solar arrays, it's really about 300 acres that would have actual solar panels. The 900 other acres would kind of be untouched for a number of reasons. Maybe the land was too slopey, too stony, not fertile for necessarily building solar panels, building, you know, mounted ground panels on it. Just a little bit about the surrounding areas and what areas actually already have solar projects. So, for example, in Greene County, that's where the closest permitted solar facility exists in the Catskills region. It received an ORES permit. It's the Flint Mine Solar Project, and that's about 400 or so acres. So the project that was submitted in Sullivan County is actually three times as large, for example. Yeah, it's huge.
Some residents and local officials are flagging concerns about this project, environmental risks and ethical concerns over the involvement of some property owners. We'll talk about those environmental risks, but let's talk about who owns the project's property.
Yeah, a lot of folks that I've spoken to are not happy about the project, as you mentioned, for environmental and then also ethical concerns. So the project site is owned by a number of property owners, but notably one of the project property owners is Walter Grigliano, who serves as Sullivan County's IDA attorney. He's also a pretty prominent figure in the community because he also owns the Catskill Mountain Sugar House.
And IDA is the developmental agency.
Yes, the IDA, thanks for reminding me. So the IDA is pretty much the local agency in Sullivan County t- tasked with like promoting economic development, attracting businesses, also offering financial tax incentives like pilots in case a developer wants to come in. So Walter Grigliano owns a significant portion of the project, and several people I spoke to raised concerns about, you know, favorable economic development conditions in which maybe the IDA, for example, would grant a pilot for this project, even though Walter Grigliano is, you know, the property owner himself. I did reach out to Mr. Grigliano, and he said, you know, he was unable to speak to the specifics of the lease terms because the lease contains a very strict NDA. But he said in an email to Radio Catskill that he would not be involved in representing or advising the IDA if the project owner approaches or applies to the IDA. I also reached out to the Sullivan County IDA themselves, Jennifer Flatt, who's the executive director. And she said, you know, the Townline Solar Project hasn't reached out to the Sullivan County IDA yet, and the project is not currently before the board for consideration. However, you know, just because, you know, the project hasn't reached the IDA itself doesn't mean that there haven't been discussions about solar project incentives, you know, battery energy policies or discussions. And when I pushed Flatt to see if, you know, if Mr. Grigliano or any of the IDA members have been involved in these discussions, she declined to comment our questions.
And nothing illegal going on here, just ethical concerns given the folks involved and
exactly
how large it is and the different, you know, multiple agencies, I guess, involved in all of this as well.
Yeah.
How have local communities responded?
You know, I'll say that overwhelmingly, at least the residents that I've spoken to, people are not happy about the project. I've went to multiple county and town board meetings in the towns of Forestburg and then also in the county meetings that I attend every Thursday. And people are very concerned specifically about the environmental concerns. The proposed project sits on about 133 wetlands, 9 ponds, 27 vernal pools, and 83 stream segments, including Melody Lake in, I believe, the town of Thompson. It's also just several hundred yards from the Neversink River, the Neversink Gorge. So one person I spoke to, his name was Christopher Titus. He's a biologist in, you know, the local area. And he was saying that, you know, any changes to the wetland or the environment has a significant impact on wildlife, on, you know, the fish in the area. It's really these small changes that can really affect, you know, an environmental area, for example.
And that's, I mean, it's a lot of animals. It's a lot of wetlands, as you mentioned. It's also old growth forest in parts of it. How are folks from the developer responding to these concerns?
Yeah, so I reached out to RWE, and they said that they've been in regular conversation with Sullivan County's officials, the local fire departments, the IDA. They hosted a community town hall in Monticello last year. And I'll say that one thing to note is that I reached out to the county, Sullivan County's Commissioner of Planning and Community Resources, Heather Brown. And this is new to the county. This is the first time that they've actually had to deal with navigating a utility scale solar project of this size. Something to keep in mind is that ORES, which is the state agency who manages the permit applications, that agency was only created in 2020, which is... It's not that long ago.
Yeah, and again, that's the Office of Renewable Energy Siting and Electric Transmission, commonly known as ORES. We're talking to Kimberly Izar, a reporter here who's been covering the proposed solar project in Sullivan County, which would be the largest in the Catskills and the Hudson Valley, and how it's drawing some environmental and ethical concerns. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about why we've been hearing more about these large solar projects in New York and Pennsylvania. It's coming up. Stay with us. This is Radio Chatsko.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
The 20-armed Sunflower Star is a highly endangered sea star in the Pacific Ocean. After an undersea pandemic nearly wiped the species out, a Northwest tribe is working to bring the sea stars back from the brink of extinction.
Pool's open!
Pool's open!
I'm Elsa Chang. Dive into that story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're continuing our conversation with our reporter, Kimberly Izar, about a solar development that has been submitted to be built in Sullivan County with through New York State. It's a large-scale solar and battery energy storage facility that spans over 1,200 acres. If approved, it would be the largest solar project in the Catskills and Hudson Valley. Some folks are pushing back about environmental risks and ethical concerns. Kim, we've been hearing a lot about these solar developments in New York and Pennsylvania. Why are we hearing so much about them, and why is there so much fierce local opposition to most of them?
Yeah, I'll start with the local opposition. I mean, the number one thing that I often hear from residents is they're concerned about these solar farms because it's going to eat up all of the farmland that we have in the United States. And ORES, which is the state agency kind of tasked with managing these solar projects, they actually came under fire just last month because the Trump administration made that same accusation and said that, you know, ORES is allowing these solar projects to use up all this farmland.
It's kind of become a talking point in right-wing media.
I hear it all the time, not only from local media, but also national media. Yeah. But when you actually start digging into the data, it actually shows a very different story, which is, and this is not in only in New York State, this is across multiple parts of the country. But essentially, when you look at the data, it shows that large-scale solar projects are only using like less than 0.1% of USDA prime farmland, and it's actually, you know, golf courses and real estate development threats such as suburban sprawl, low density residential housing that's actually using more prime farmland than solar panels.
And part of the solar push in New York is somewhat related to the state moving toward its mandate of 100% zero emissions energy.
Absolutely.
By 2040,
yeah.
Which I think people are commingling here a little bit. But what are folks saying at like the state level and some other organizations?
I mean, the state mandate is a huge part of it.
Yeah.
Just as a reminder for folks, you know, in 2019, the state passed the New York Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which outlined that by 2040, the state has to have 100% zero emissions. But also, like, something to keep in mind is that the state's electric grid is kind of falling apart.
Not in the best shape.
It's not in the best shape. And we're seeing that as everyday consumers. We're seeing our electric bills go up. We're seeing during the summertime more blackouts because the electric grid is already struggling. It's really, really old. And so what we're seeing is that in addition to the demand for electricity increasing. So all of these things coming together, we're seeing that we need as a state to produce more electricity, and we need to produce more renewable energy for a number of reasons, partially because of state mandates and partially because we just need more electricity across the state.
Well, yeah. And so who decides if the solar project is built then with all of this going on?
Yes, the important question. I mean, ultimately, it's ORES who decides whether or not a solar project receives a siting permit. I reached out to ORES and they said that before an application is accepted, that an application receives extensive input from local governments and communities. And I'll say, you know, I've spoken to Sullivan County officials and they said, you know, RWE, the town line solar developer, has checked all the boxes. They've reached out to the local fire departments. They've reached out to the local officials and residents. They had a community open house, as I mentioned. They've done all their due diligence. They submitted their application to ORES.
They have about 60 people from their staff working on this.
Yes.
Spanning from biologists and wildlife experts to engineers and even acoustics experts.
They have it all. And from there, pretty much what happens next is that ORES has to decide if the application is complete. They have 60 days to respond to RWE. And then after the application is marked complete, ORES can issue or deny a siting permit within 12 months. One thing I'll note, though, is when I spoke to Heather Brown from Sullivan County, she said that, you know, 12 months is actually a short amount of time in government land.
Yeah.
Usually things in local and state governments move much slower. We often see processes take several years. So 12 months is, she felt, was a short amount of time.
So what happens next?
So what happens next is, right now, I think people are going through the ORES application. If you go on the Department of Public Service website, it's over 120 documents. It's a lot. So even myself, I'm going through all of these documents. Some of these documents are several hundred pages. So ORES is reviewing this application. One thing I'll note is now that the developer has submitted a formal application to ORES, Sullivan County and the towns of Forestburg and Thompson can actually access what is called community intervener funds. And what that does is it allows the county and the local towns to access legal representation, do environmental assessment. That way, all of these things don't fall on the Sullivan County taxpayer.
That's Kimberly Eisauer reporting on the large-scale, utility-scale solar development that's been proposed in Sullivan County. It extends between the towns of Thompson and Forestburg. It would be located near the Marcy South power line, a high-voltage power transmission line. And it would also be the largest facility in the Catskills and Hudson Valley, if approved. You can read Kim's report at WJFFradio.org. There are links to the application and many other documents. We'd also like to thank the Sunlight Research Desk for providing research for this story. Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we'll talk more about the Asian longhorned tick expanding its reach. Reporter Olivia Sipple explains why Cornell researchers say prevention is the best defense as the invasive species becomes increasingly common. This is Radio Chatskill.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, 5 days in Palestine, we go all the way to the West Bank to ask this question: what drives Latino solidarity with Palestinians?
Connection to land has been my compass, especially seeing so many injustices in the world. How land is really at the root of it all.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. Ticks have long been a concern during summer, but experts say one invasive species is posing a growing threat to livestock and could eventually affect people, too. The Asian longhorned tick is spreading across the region, and researchers say prevention is the best defense. Reporter Olivia Sipple reports on what farmers, pet owners, and anyone spending time outdoors should know.
Asian longhorned ticks are here to stay in New York, which means protection is key to making sure the diseases they carry do not become harmful to livestock and people. Last Thursday at the Cornell Cooperative Extension in Albany County, Joelle and Marie Lapman presented TickStock. The event brought livestock farmers together to learn about the threat common ticks can pose to humans and their animals.
So I am here today to talk about ticks on livestock, and I am so grateful to be here because I have been working on this for a number of years, and I feel like I've been just screaming from the housetops and nobody's been paying attention. But now that they're actually here, people are definitely paying attention. So I get my moment.
For now, we are focusing on one in particular. Across the state, Asian longhorn tick populations are increasing and becoming an issue, in part because they are extremely invasive. Let's take a listen to what Joellen had to say about how they first showed up here in the United States, and particularly in New York.
When it comes to this Asian longhorn tick, part of the reason that we didn't discover it for so long was that it looks almost identical to our native rabbit tick. So when we went back into our collections, we're like, oh, that's not a rabbit tick. We were learning. So we actually discovered that it's been in the United States since 2010. We just didn't discover it until 2017.
Since the tick was classified, researchers have been testing to see how these ticks are infiltrating farms and where they tend to thrive.
So the results from last year, we found on one farm over 3,000, well, we found over 3,000 on the two farms that had the Asian longhorn tick, with the vast majority of them being the Asian longhorn tick. Most of them were found on the grazed pasture or the grazed edge. This actually surprised me a little bit. I was expecting to find more in the brush areas. And this does not break it down by species.
One of the tools the Institute uses is a tick rag, a simple piece of gear that turns out to be very effective. For our purposes, Joellen was able to show us what it looks like.
So again, this is what this looks like. This is very high tech. We're just dragging this along the ground, and if the ticks are actually hunting, they're going to grab onto the white sheet, and then we can look to see what kind of ticks there are out there.
As she raised it in the air, it appeared to be a horizontal brown rod with a long white fabric attached to it. Tick dragging, a form of testing a site outdoors, helps track where ticks are likely to be by following how they move and where they drop.
We're out there. And so they get ready. And then when something brushes against them, they're going to grab on. And then they're going to climb to high places. So you will have heard that they're dropping out of trees. What's actually happening is that they get on really low and then they climb up to the high places. So we're using that hunting style against them. We're also not going, we're not treated, we're not wearing repellents as we're going out there. We are using ourselves as bait to capture as many ticks as we possibly can. You're welcome. then we bring this all back to the lab, and we throw these things underneath the microscope so that we can figure out exactly what kind we're dealing with. When it comes to
one of the biggest concerns with Asian longhorn ticks is how quickly their population can grow.
So this is a true invasive species. We think that it came either from Australia or New Zealand, where it is also an invasive species. They come originally from the Southeast Asian continent. You will notice that there is only one adult up there. She can clone herself. So we have found only one male in the United States, and it was kind of wonky and not able to mate. So she, all by herself, as long as she gets her three blood meals, is able to lay 2,000 eggs that are all going to be females. So these numbers can ramp up incredibly quickly. So just one can start a whole population.
Another concern is that Asian longhorn ticks do not seem picky about their environment, unlike other tick species that tend to prefer a certain climate or habitat.
Their preferred habitat is kind of everywhere. Mostly we've been seeing these, most of our experience is downstate, like on Staten Island. They're in people's lawns, they're in the forest, they're just everywhere. Their preferred hosts, they really thrive on livestock more than anything else. But we're also finding them on deer and medium-sized mammals and birds, which are dispersing them.
That could be especially dangerous when these ticks attach to livestock. There have already been cases where farmers have had to handpick hundreds of ticks off their cows.
Here is, on the left, this is a picture from a farm in Columbia County where there's a pretty high population of them. She is handpicking these ticks off on a daily basis, and about this many ticks is what she's dealing with almost every day. The video on the right, which will hopefully work, this is a utility truck that was parked in a right-of-way in Westchester County.
In the image she showed on the screen, a cow's lower body was covered with ticks. The video showed a car mirror coated in ticks, so dense that the reflection light off the side mirror seemed to glow.
So this kind of gives us an indication that they are very drawn to carbon dioxide because they had left the truck running. And I turned off the audio because there's some pretty salty language going on as they're videotaping those ticks that are kind of covering their truck. So that's what we're dealing with, really huge numbers of these things.
For cows, this tick can be more than just an annoyance. It can make them sick by causing anemia, destroying red blood cells, and leaving animals lethargic.
Two ways that we know Tularia can be spread. One is by reusing needles, so please don't do that, because this is going to be spreading throughout New York relatively quickly, and through this Asian longhorn tick. There's some evidence that can also be transmitted by flies, and that's being looked at by another group of people. But right now we know that most of the transmission is happening by ticks. So the health risk is that Tularia orientalis. Also, by sheer numbers, we've got a lot of blood loss that's going on. And there have been deaths. And we actually don't know whether this is just from sheer blood loss or is it a reaction to something in the tick's saliva? That's something that we're working on trying to figure out.
There has been testing at different farms across the state whenever there is an outbreak. While researchers do not yet have all the answers about how this tick population will continue to affect farms, they are working on several fronts.
So we have a number of farms that we had been visiting. We're looking to identify which species are prevalent on cattle pastures, establish the patterns of the tick species and their distributions throughout the pasture system so that we could develop a risk assessment tool.
On the prevention side, one way to stop diseases from spreading on the farm and to keep more ticks from dropping off cows after they arrive is to put safety measures in place from the start.
So we've got knowledge, we've got inspection, we have habitat modification. Now let's look at animal protection. If you are bringing new animals into your facility, test them for Tularia. Make sure that they treat the cattle for ticks before you bring them onto your property. So regular quarantining is not going to work, because if they have ticks on them and you put them into your quarantine pen, the ticks are just going to drop off them and then they're going to work their way out from there. So you really want to make sure they're tick-free before they come to your property.
For people, the basic safety measures may sound familiar, but Joellen emphasizes that they still matter. Here, she walks us through the precautions she takes and encourages others to take as well.
So I'm tucked in here. Very important. If I'm out and about, then I'm also tucked in here because then they have to climb and until they get to an area. Permethrin-treated clothing. The three most important things, the three T's, are tuck, treat with permethrin, and you're all told to do a tick check, touch. Our eyes can only get us so far. If you use your fingertips to look for those poppy seed-sized things, you'll be much more effective at finding them than if you're just using your eyes. So tuck, treat, and touch. Three, repellents help. It depends on what I'm doing. If I am doing my research, all I'm doing is tucking and doing a really thorough tick check at the end.
Throughout the night, Joellen made it clear she does not have all the answers. As the population has rapidly increased, she has focused on researching, testing, and tracking the long-term impacts these ticks can have on New York's environment and farms. For now, she encourages farmers who have questions or who suspect they have an Asian longhorn tick population to reach out so she could test the site and help assess next steps. For more information about different tick species in New York and the risks they pose, visit Cornell's Integrated Pest Management page on the Asian longhorn tick. In Voiceville, I'm Olivia Sipple for Radio Catskill.
Coming up, we'll get a preview of this year's Borscht Belt Fest in Ellenville. This is Radio Catskill.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
This Week in This American Life.
I just think we're opening a whole can of worms here that we don't want to be.
To better understand testosterone and its effects, I and the staff of the radio show get our testosterone levels checked to see who has the most.
For the men, I think it'll be a big deal. You'll know when you're talking to each other who beat you. I think it'll change everything.
This whole thing is going to lead to heartbreak.
Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. The Borscht Belt Fest returns to Ellenville this weekend, celebrating the Catskills' rich legacy of comedy, music, food, and Jewish culture. Jamie Lee Anson is the director of Borscht Belt Fest, and she joins us now with a preview. Jamie Lee, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me today. We're all excited about this weekend. Talk about the weather. It's beautiful, right?
Good.
So we have an amazing event going on for comedy, cuisine, and culture. It has a little bit of everything for everybody. I have an expanded children's area with the princess meet and greet, where you can meet your favorite princess and get photos with fairies and princesses, and free crafts for the children. And not only that, but for the adults, I have like free sampling and purchasing. I have a 1940 Catskill tap and ladder coming that is serving local ales from the Hudson Valley. And we have the best of the Hudson Valley vendors there. We have live music and a little bit of klezmer music, so you get a little bit of history and culture. And then throughout the event, you can enjoy different menus from around the world, but also there is comedians of the era, and then there's also like history programs that you can join in on to learn about the history of Catskill. It's going to be a great event.
2 days. Obviously, you're really excited about it, and you've helped grow this into a major regional event. How do you think it's evolved over the years?
I think it just has become, I always think a festival becomes a village, right? Because it takes a village. It takes that many volunteers, and thank you to the wonderful volunteers. But also, we have sponsors that are so important to us. So we have the Hudson Valley Credit Union, which is local to Ellenville and Ulster County. Excuse my voice for a second. They're bringing a booth that's going to be amazing. Manischewitz is bringing a kosher hot dog truck. So we have, like, all kinds of different great things are happening. I actually have a Borscht bus coming from New York City that's going to have a comedian on the bus. And you could take the trip up from the city and enjoy the comedian while you're riding on the bus to come up. So we're doing all kinds of fun things. We have R&B and soul band Zizim in the morning on stage. And then you can just walk around and enjoy good food and vendors. I think the growth happens because there's such an amazing selection of vendors in the Hudson Valley alone. So this will showcase the best of the Hudson Valley.
One of this year's featured talks is Before Woodstock, the music of the original Catskills counterculture. What story does that presentation tell, and how does it connect the Borscht Belt into the cultural changes that followed along in the 60s?
I've been learning hard and fast about, I love history first off, but there were 943 resorts built from the Jewish culture up in the Borscht Belt. So the thing that is fascinating to me, there's about maybe 11 active resorts now, but these were resorts that you'd spend your whole summer and you'd enjoy your family and everything about it. So the before the Woodstock was the Borscht Belt. So it's about the history of our whole area and how it's changed over the years. So it's a fascinating program to learn about our local history and how rich it is.
And when you talk about resorts in the area, the folks often associate the Borscht Belt with stand-up comedy. Music was just as important. Another program, Borscht Belt Rhythm and Beats, the musical melting pot, is exploring that music. What can audiences expect from that?
There's a very seasoned panel of musicians that are coming to explain the different types of music that were going on during the different eras. But also afterwards, one of the bands is going to be performing on stage for 2 hours. So you get like a little taste of the history, and then you get to immerse yourself in the music afterwards.
And there's also a performance by a group called the Isle of Klesmos and a wide range of other musicians. Talk a little bit more about this year's entertainment lineup and how it's reflecting both the history and present day Catskills.
Sure. We have an impersonator for Bessie Smith that's coming in that's going to be doing Bessie Smith music. We have Zazim, which is R&B, Marvin Gaye, Aretha Franklin, that kind of soulful feel. Then we have folk music. We have all different genres of music. We're ending the day with Dr. Ted and the Stone and Isle of Klesmos, like a spin on klezmer music that is new. It's a little bit of jazz, a little bit of rock. It's going to be fantastic. So there's a full day of all kinds of different music. Blue Flame is also going to be performing, and they're a classic rock and roll band. So we have all different pockets of different musicians and different activities through the whole site. So I think it's going to be wonderful. And Aroma Time, Bistro and Restaurant, love them. They're hosting a Borscht Belt brunch. So you get a true menu for a brunch that you can sit down and relax. And while you are relaxing, we will be telling you stories about the Borscht Belt. And it's part of, you know, you get to experience some of the history while you're having your delicious brunch at Aroma Time.
We've also touched on the, you know, the food vendors, the makers market, a street fair, activities for children too. How are you introducing younger visitors to a history they may not know very much about?
You know, we're introducing, and throughout the streets, you're going to see vintage store windows set up. So we've taken over some of the empty storefronts and created vignettes that represent what was happening at the resorts. So children in all ages can walk around and immerse themselves in, wow, look at those outfits, look at that scene, you know. And then at the children's area, we have environmental crafts. So they're going to be doing their own little sunflower pots and decorating the pots that they can take with them. And there's all different things. The museum is also open, so you can take your children there and just learn about the whole history of the whole area. So that'll be open for the public the whole weekend. So we're going to be doing all kinds of things.
Yeah, I wanted to mention the Catskills Borscht Belt Museum. It's become an anchor for preserving this history. How did the museum and the festival complement one another throughout the year?
The museum actually has different programs all year round. Like, we just celebrated Melbrook's 100th birthday. So every month there is, if you go to the Borscht Belt Museum website, you can see that we have different programs every year to enjoy.
And we talked about younger audiences and, you know, attracting them. We've also seen renewed interest in the Borscht Belt through documentaries, books, and shows like The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Are you seeing that younger audience coming to the festival because they're curious about the area and want to learn more about the history?
Yes, absolutely. We're seeing a big flux of different age groups coming in. The other thing is we have this really fun thing called the Jewish Dating Game, which is a really fun spin on the original show, The Dating Game. And it's actually couples are getting matched up, but you get a little bit of cocktail, you get a little bit of swag, you get a little bit of auction, and you get to have fun watching the whole scene. So we have like different activities through that targeted for a younger audience, too.
Beyond celebrating this history, what do you think the festival means for Ellenville and the surrounding region in terms of, you know, tourism, local businesses, and community pride?
I think the community pride is very important in Ellenville. I've been seeing such a rich audience come to help me throughout this whole process of the festival. And, you know, people will offer, hey, I know where you can get the vintage outfit for your store window, or, hey, I've got an idea for an activity. And it's been wonderful to watch how the village has come together to create this atmosphere for such a great event. I think that that's all part of being a part of a good community in the Hudson Valley, you know, pulling together and having a fantastic experience that brings a little history, a little laughter, a little cuisine. It's just perfect for Hudson Valley.
And it's a two-day event this Saturday and Sunday in Ellenville.
Yes.
If someone's never attended before, how do you map out the perfect visit? What are some of the can't-miss events, do you think?
I think when you come into our event that you really need to look at the comedians, the headliners that we have involved, because the festival is free for you. So you can walk around and enjoy anything with the shopping or the food that you want to do, but then choose a couple of the programs like you were talking about. The panelists are wonderful to talk to, but also you can stay a little later and involve yourself in some of the comedy shows that are amazing. And I think it'll give you an essence of what it was like. Could you imagine back in the day being able to go to one of these hotels and seeing Joan Rivers on stage, or Frank Sinatra, or Rodney Dangerfield? All these people performed at the Catskill Resorts, and they were known that they became known from their performing at the Catskill Resorts. So I think with this festival, it brings a little bit of importance of what our history is, but also a little laughter in our life and some beautiful music.
Finally, where can listeners find the full schedule, you know, get any tickets for any of the ticketed events, and learn more about the Borscht Belt Fest?
BorschtBeltFest.org. So that's BorschtBelt, BeltFest.org. And there's a full schedule up online. There's also a vendor map, so you can see what beautiful vendors we have. So everything's right online for you. You can get your tickets. You can get all the information you need there.
And Radio Catskill is going to be there, too. So we're looking forward to it.
Yes, I have you right by the museum.
Fantastic. So, perfect.
Yeah. So I thought that would be a great spot for you.
That's a great spot. Thank you so much. And how are you doing going into this weekend? Are you getting some rest?
Oh, I'm excited. Please don't mind my voice. I've been talking to a lot of vendors and sponsors, making sure everybody's on board and everything's excited for them. So my voice is a little gravelly today because of it. So I apologize.
No worries.
But I'm excited about it. I'm so excited because I always, as an event, look for Mother Nature to help me out too. Like, and this weekend, it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's beautiful sunny weekend. Come out with your family, come enjoy, and you could do some sampling with City Winery and some of the distilleries. There's Do Good Spirits, and there's all kinds of things to do for all ages. And I'm very excited about the princesses.
Yeah.
I actually have a funny story about the princesses. The last event I did, I noticed that there were a lot of men standing on the line to meet the princesses. And I was like, I don't see children with them. And I went up and I tapped one guy on the shoulder. I said, excuse me, do you have a child? Is that why you're online? And he said, no, I need my selfie with the princess. And I was like, okay. So like I said, it's for all ages. So, you know, it's just something to enjoy, the best of the Hudson Valley, the best food, and learn a little bit about the culture and the cuisine of the day, and, you know, what happened in Catskill. And then visit the museum. There's a couple of great private tours going on. So you can sign up for private tours. You can sign up for the history of music or culture or architecture. There's just a little bit of everything for all ages there this weekend.
That's Jamie Lee Anson, the festival director for Borscht Belt Fest, working hard for this two-day event coming up this weekend in Ellenville. More information at borschtbeltfest.org, and we'll be there too. And we're looking forward to it. Jamie, thank you so much.
You're welcome, and I hope to see you there, right?
Yeah, we'll see you there. Thank you.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Coming up, we'll hear about a new exhibit, Women of Substance, an art exhibit celebrating the creativity and contributions of women artists and why it's time to redefine those stories and how they're told in the art world. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, Ira Flatto here from Science Friday. We view sci-fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
The 20-armed sunflower star is a highly endangered sea star in the Pacific Ocean. After an undersea pandemic nearly wiped the species out, a Northwest tribe is working to bring the sea stars back from the brink of extinction.
Pools open!
Pools open!
I'm Elsa Chang. Dive into that story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. A new exhibit is celebrating the work of women artists while challenging long-standing disparities in the art world. Women of Substance brings together the work of 10 painters, mixed media artists, and ceramicists whose contributions curator Eileen Bernstein say deserve greater recognition. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with her about the inspiration behind the show, the artists featured, and why exhibits like this continue to matter.
The Arts Nest Gallery in Lake Huntington is presenting Women of Substance. And there are a lot of women of substance there at the Arts Nest Gallery. And Eileen Bernstein is going to tell us about these women and this exhibit that she has curated. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, Valerie. Okay, so just briefly, the women that are in this show, the artists, both painters, mixed media, and ceramic artists, are women that have deeply influenced my personal life and growth as an artist and a human. So I thought to honor them and create a space where we can share our work as artists, a place where our ideas and creative processes are valued and shared with the community and the world around us. So it's a big order.
Yes, it is. And you sent me a video of the exhibit. And I must say, it does look quite beautiful in there. And that is not the easiest place to exhibit art.
Right. Well, yeah, hopefully I've attempted to transform the space and create more light and bring some color. A lot of the paintings are very, very colorful, but at the same time, there's a lot of earth tones and wood-fired ceramics and raku, and it's just a really varied and interesting exhibit.
There is a lot to see.
There's over 90 pieces, if you count them. But yeah, it's a very varied show. And
so you've had to put a lot of work into this.
Yes. It's actually my first time curating a show. But ideas come to me just sort of spontaneously. So I just came up with this initial idea of Women of Substance and to include all these wonderful artists that have influenced my life.
And tell us a little bit about yourself and your artwork.
Well, I don't consider myself a professional artist, but I was doing ceramics for many, many years, and then it sort of morphed into sculptures. And most recently, in the past 4 years, I've been sculpting marble, and I'm now studying at the Woodstock School of Art, sculpting alabaster and different kinds of stones. That's part of my journey.
And you've also studied abroad.
Yes, yeah. I went to Italy to this wonderful place, Pietrasanta, near where the Carrara marble comes from, and sculpted marble there with really great teachers. And I'm going to be going back.
When?
In March of 2027.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. Because if not now, when?
Yes, I hear you. I hear you. You're also involved with the opera.
Yes, yeah. I'm a board member of the Delaware Valley Opera, and I actually sang with them many, many years ago when I was a soprano.
you say was?
Yeah, my voice has become more like a contralto, but I just sing for fun now, not in the opera.
Had you performed in other music events over the years?
Yeah, I did a lot of choral singing in New York City. I was a music teacher in the New York City public schools in the Bronx. And then I also sing at the open mic night at the Arts Nest starting in September, Tuesday nights. So, you know, I do more like folk, blues, pop kind of singing.
So you have quite a range of interests.
Yes. That's always been a problem.
Well, you put it to good use.
I hope so.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Everyone should come out to the Arts Nest, particularly the reception and artist talk on Sunday, July 26th, between 1:30 and 3:30 at the Arts Nest in Lake Huntington, New York.
And how many artists are part of this exhibit?
There's 9 women represented, kind of like the 9 muses.
Wow. And over 90 pieces of art.
Right.
So they've been busy too.
Absolutely. And they were all like super helpful. And it's a great community of artists that we have here in Sullivan County. It's amazing.
Well, thank you for sharing this with our listeners, and I'm wishing you a wonderful exhibit.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
The Women of Substance Art Exhibition runs through August 31st at the Delaware Valley Opera Gallery. More information at DelawareValleyOpera.org. And before we go, have you downloaded the new and improved Radio Catskill app? Well, it's free, and it's available for Apple and Android devices. You can stream your favorite shows and podcasts, stay connected with local and national news, send us audio or video feedback, take Radio Catskill wherever you go. Go download it now, and we look forward to traveling around with you wherever you're going. Take us along. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville, and at vintagehousejville.com, and from listeners like you.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got the exotic sounds of Don Tiki, the Waitiki 7, and Les Baxter, plus the wild percussion of Dick Shorey. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Hope you'll join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, 5 days in Palestine, we go all the way to the West Bank to ask this question: what drives Latino solidarity with Palestinians?
Connection to land has been my compass, especially seeing so many injustices in the world. How land is really at the root of it all.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, well, we've made it through a rough and tumble period of rain, thunderstorms, and potential tornadoes. It looks like now sunshine for the rest of the afternoon, 76, and pleasant for the rest of the week through the weekend. Tonight, mainly clear and cooler, low 52. Sunshine Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, with highs in the mid to upper 70s. Nice. On Point is coming up next.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
It's 11 o'clock.